After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
The mental factor of ignorance or delusion is the core problem. Like you can't have anger or greed without ignorance in the background. And you can eliminate through spiritual pursuits, you can eliminate anger, aspects of anger and aspects of greed, but you can never be enlightened if you don't get to the root, which is ignorance or delusion. And so there's a way of understanding even the Four Noble Truths and, you know, the second noble truth that we usually think of as the cause of suffering being craving or thirst or whatever. But from the Abhidhamma perspective, the cause of suffering, the root cause, is ignorance or delusion.
Hello and welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. My name is Lily Cushman and I produce this podcast. We're coming to you today with episode 220, continuing our real life series on the podcast. This series is in celebration of Sharon's new book by the same name, Real Life. And we've been exploring many of the different themes from the book, moving from contraction to expansion, the larger journeys and cycles we take. And for today's episode, we are so delighted to welcome back Mark Epstein. Mark has been on the podcast a couple times before. He's an old friend, an old colleague of Sharon's. If you don't know his work, you're in for quite a treat. I'll let Sharon read his full bio for you at the start of the interview, but just to say that Sharon and Mark have been friends since, I think, 1975 when they met at Naropa, and recently Mark sent us a photo of that first summer at Naropa, and everybody just had incredible hair, so young. So Mark is a psychiatrist. He's a longtime Buddhist seeker, practitioner. A lot of his books include different themes and teachings of the Dharma, and he has just an incredible way of synthesizing, both from the Western lens of mental health and psychology, psychiatry, and also the Eastern approach to these aspects of the human experience. So it's a wonderful conversation. It's a treat to have Mark back on the podcast. Before we dive in, a couple of quick announcements. We are excited to announce one of Sharon's books is being re-released this month on August 1st, Love Your Enemies, which is a book she co-authored with the venerable Robert Thurman, Bob Thurman. And this book originally came out 10 years ago. And the new edition, celebrating the 10-year anniversary, has just been released this week. If you're listening to this at a later date, that is the week of August 1st, 2023. And this is a book that in some ways was ahead of its time. It feels like perfect medicine for these very polarizing times. It is focusing on working with both inner and outer enemies, and I put enemies in quotation marks because that is the common translation to the word from the Buddhist teachings in Pali or in Sanskrit. And so it's a very interesting approach to working with both people who are in our lives that we feel really challenged by or in conflict with, but also in our internal landscape, aspects of ourselves that we may have such challenges with or just not be able to maybe integrate into our full being. So it's a wonderful offering, and we're excited to have this new edition coming into the world. It has a new introduction, and yeah, let us know how you like the book. This apparently is the year of many book releases, so we're enjoying the journey of that this year. And if you'd like to get a copy of that book, you can visit SharonSalzberg.com or just check out any of the places that you normally get your books. Amazon, The Bookshop, which is a great retailer that sources local bookstores, or your local library. Okay, let's dive into today's episode number 220 of the Meta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg and the wonderful Mark Epstein.
Welcome back to the summit. I'm Sharon Salzberg. I'm very pleased to welcome my longtime friend and colleague, really longtime friend and colleague, Mark Epstein, MD, to talk with me about the journey from isolation to freedom. Mark is a psychiatrist in private practice in New York City. He's a longtime Buddhist practitioner and received his undergraduate and medical degrees from Harvard University. Mark is the author of several books that explore the interface of Buddhism and psychotherapy, including Thoughts Without a Thinker, Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, Going on Being, Psychotherapy Without the Self, The Trauma of Everyday Life, and Advice Not Given. His latest work, The Zen of Therapy, Uncovering a Hidden Kindness in Life, was released in January 2022 by Penguin Press. Hello, Mark.
Sharon.
The so passage of time. We knew each other when we were very young people.
Yeah. Summer of 1974.
That's right.
Before I turned 21.
Wow.
Yeah. So just a few years ago.
A few years ago. There you go, quickly. So to begin with, you come to both therapy and mindfulness meditation as a practitioner, as a seeker, so to speak. And yeah. I'm curious if you could describe what put you on the path and what helped you find your footing on that path.
Well, I came to mindfulness and to Buddhism really before I came to psychotherapy. So that was an unusual way to start in our culture at that time, because mindfulness was not everywhere the way it's not everywhere yet either, but it's more everywhere. It's more somewhere now. I first heard about it my freshman year in college. I took an Introduction to World Religion class, and the whole first semester was about Eastern religion, and the whole second semester was about Western religion. The Eastern religion part, the little module on Buddhism, the text was the Dhammapada, and there were verses in the Dhammapada that went straight into my heart or into my mind, you know, about how unwieldy the mind is, you know, how the anxious mind is like a fish flapping on dry ground, you know. And I was like, oh, that's definitely me. So that sort of oriented me towards Buddhism. And then I kept coming upon it. I was taking psychology classes, Danny Goleman, Daniel Goleman, was a section person, a graduate student in a psychophysiology class. And he had already been to India with Ram Dass. Maybe you knew him already at this point. This would have been 1972 or something. But I sensed something in him that I knew I wanted more of. And it wasn't explicit, but it was something coming off of him. And I did my best to make friends with him outside of class and said, I want to know what you know. And he said, oh, if you want to know what I know, you should go out to Boulder this summer or next summer, because my friends will all be teaching there. So I did. And that's where I met you and Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Ram Dass. And so that, and that was a huge immersion. You know, that was like right away I could practice because I had teachers. And that that summer, and then the experiences that followed on that summer, doing retreats before you founded IMS, you know, but the early retreats in Mendocino and in Bucksport and in Great Barrington gave me enough. Like I felt like, oh, this is a real thing. This meditation, it's not just something I'm reading about. It's something that something I can access, you know, and that actually gave me you might say the freedom or the self-confidence to pursue the study of Western psychotherapy. I felt like I already had something. But before all that, I felt like I had nothing. I didn't know who or what I was. And now, after those retreats and so on, I was much more comfortable with not knowing who or what I was. And I thought, oh, that's a stance I can take that to help other people. And so that led me into the psychotherapy world, which, you know, I can talk about if you ask me another question. That was a whole. So then I had parallel paths that kept kept interacting, you know, which is still going on, those interactions.
So I did know Danny. I met him toward the end of 1970 in India, and he's the one who told me about this meditation retreat he was going to in January of 1971 in Bodh Gaya, India. And that was my first retreat. So he's sort of been like the Pied Piper.
Wow.
For any number of people.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah. Much merit that Dan Goldman.
Yeah.
Accrued. So I quote you, I hope you actually said this, as saying sometimes that therapy is like meditating out loud. Is that true? Did you say that?
I hope so. But now that you've quoted me as saying it, let's assume yes. I definitely have always approached therapy as a dynamic meditation, as a two-person, as an interpersonal meditation. That was really my frame for it, because I came into it by going to medical school, which is a weird way to become a therapist, because mostly what you learn in medical school has nothing to do with therapy. But then when you do a psychiatry rotation, which is how you first get access in medical school, you know, for a month you go around with the psychiatrist and you pretend to be one, and they give you a patient or two to be therapist, because it's like in surgery, you know, you learn surgery by stitching up at the end of an operation, or you learn medicine by seeing a patient and figuring out which antibiotic to give. So they follow that same thing with psychiatry. So, okay, you're a medical student, but you're going to be the psychiatrist. So all of a sudden I was in a room with a patient, and I had very little training other than being on meditation retreats. And by that time I'd been in therapy myself, so I knew how to imitate my therapist. But really, alone in the room with a patient, what did I have to draw on about being a therapist? And mostly I had my experience in meditation. And I remember thinking, if I can give this person, you know, the same kind of attention, or close enough, the same kind of attention that I've learned to give to my own mind, then hopefully that'll be therapeutic. She ended up liking me, and I think in that month, I only had a month of pretending to be a psychiatrist, but I think in that month I helped her a little bit, but that stayed with me as a kind of premise for being a therapist.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to Barbara Fredrickson the other day, in another context, and she was telling me about research that is considered kind of more cutting edge right now, which is about therapy, which is about meditation and its effect on someone else, you know?
Oh, interesting.
Kind of in this duo role. And I thought of your quotation, actually.
Yeah, I always thought, you know, this latest book that I wrote was a description of a year's worth of therapy cases. So I was trying to talk about, everyone always wants to know, how do you bring Buddhism, how do you bring mindfulness into your practice? And I was always evading the question because I always thought, if it's in me, if it's real in me, it should come out in some way. But then I tried in the book to just show how ordinary therapy is, you know, and yet at the same time, could there be some kind of transmission? You know, am I, Freud always talked about the psychoanalysis as being one unconscious reflecting another unconscious, the way the newly invented telephone worked, you know, with vibrations communicating between people. So he was into the unconscious vibrations reverberating between therapist and patient. And I think something like that, you know, might go on, although we call it the placebo effect, you know, scientific term for it.
Is it Bion or Beyond?
Beyond. Wilfred Beyond. Yeah.
So can you explain his theory? I mean, because it's something almost like an extension of that, right? It's like the space created.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Beyond was a famous British psychoanalyst who was actually born in India. And he was Samuel Beckett's psychoanalyst. So he's got a good history. And he's the person that I stole the line "Thoughts Without a Thinker" from. That came from him. But he wrote a lot about the interpersonal space that's created between patient and therapist, and about the unconscious transmissions and what came to be called a projective identification. So the way that a therapist might be feeling something, but that feeling might not belong actually to the therapist. It might be an aspect, something that the patient is feeling but can't quite deal with. So it's by some mysterious process, it's excommunicated from the patient, but put into the body of the therapist, who then has to discover it. And that's how scientific psychoanalysis has tried to be, that's a very important concept in psychoanalysis, that events like that can happen, transmissions like that can happen. Mm. Why can't it go the other way, you know? But
Well, you know, I'm like fascinated by your college thesis. I've remembered it all these years, you know, which was on Buddhist psychology.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you were drawn to that approach right away, if it was your early exploration of psychology that just made sense. How did you even access it?
Well, my college thesis that you're remembering was on Abhidhamma, which is the Buddhist psychology, like the chemistry of the mind. It takes the mind and divides it into 52 or 50, it depends on which tradition of Buddhism, but into something greater than 50 mental factors. And it talks about our everyday experience as basically the patterning of the mental factors, and then how that patterning changes with meditation, you know, which helpful or wholesome mental factors are accentuated in meditation and which ones are diminished, and how that changes with the different insights that come in advanced meditation. And you know, you're fascinated by it because not the first summer at Naropa, but the second summer at Naropa, when Danny Goleman didn't come at the last minute and he asked me to help teach a course that you and Jack were teaching, all I had to go on was my thesis. But so what I did in my thesis was basically go to the basement of the Widener Library, which was the big Harvard library, where in those days you could still get to the books. It wasn't all digitized. And they had an incredible, like, shelves and shelves of books by mostly German Jewish explorers of Theravada Buddhism, who had escaped Austria and Germany in the 30s and gone to Sri Lanka and India. One man named Sigmund Fenninger, who became known as Nyanaponika Thera, you know, who wrote a great book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, and another one named Jnana Taloka. But anyway, all these books that described Buddhist psychology, described the Abhidhamma, were sitting in the basement of Widener and had never been taken out. And I had Danny Goleman as my thesis advisor. And at Naropa, I had started taking courses already, not just with you and Jack and Joseph and Ramdas, but also with a guy named Stephen Goodman, who went on to become a professor in California, who had studied with Herbert Gunther. So the Abhidhamma stuff was out there, and I needed a thesis. And I thought, Buddhist psychology, what could be better? So I tried to make sense of it. And I spent my senior year at in college trying to make sense of the Abhidhamma. And I was just putting it together for myself. But I think I did make pretty good sense of it. And it was useful. It's been useful for me in all of my writing. It's like a foundational thing, you know, that ignorance, for instance, ignorance or delusion, the mental factor of ignorance or delusion, is the core problem. Like, you can't have anger or greed without ignorance in the background. And you can eliminate, through spiritual pursuits, you can eliminate anger, aspects of anger and aspects of greed, but you can never be enlightened if you don't get to the root, which is ignorance or delusion. And so there's a way of understanding even the Four Noble Truths and, you know, the second noble truth that we usually think of as the cause of suffering being craving or thirst or whatever. But from the Abhidhamma perspective, the cause of suffering, the root cause, is ignorance or delusion. And that's ignorance or delusion about the self, which is what brings in the psychological element, you know, what it is that we cling to in fundamentally is the sense of ourselves as separate, isolated, alone, but also concrete, real, more real than we actually are. And so then that sets up a battle between us and the world, you know, where basically on some level deep down it's us against the world or the world against us. And so we're bound to lose, and that's where the suffering, you know. So I found all that incredibly helpful as I pursued both being a therapist and a student of meditation.
Well, you know, the through line is really, I think, that whole system of psychology in a way is set up to help answer the question, how can there be thoughts without a thinker?
Yeah.
Like, how can this entire universe of appearances arise without anything substantial, anything that could be clung to, anything that is stable or lasting? It's like, how did that happen?
I know.
Why isn't there just like nothing?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's something.
But it's something.
Something and nothing. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so it's a really interesting system to explore, you know, and so yeah. Thank you for your thesis.
Well, all I did was, it was all there already. You know, that's the, and I also found it very helpful as I did more retreats with you guys, because it's not like my experiences totally matched up with what it said in The Progress of Insight, you know, Mahasi Sayadaw's, and how it's supposed to be. But it's not that different either, you know. So the fact that there's a roadmap or a cartography, you know, for what happens in the mind if you learn to leave it alone, that it that idea of self-liberation, you know, is actually, it's not just made up, you know, it seems to be true, true to the extent that it can be written about and described. I mean, that's incredible.
Well, some of those mental factors, let's say, as they would put it, have the nature when we are lost in them, when we're when we take them to heart, when we identify with them, not just through their sheer arising, but when we have that kind of relationship with them. So many experiences and emotions and perceptions, if we are lost in them, cause us to constrict. Our world gets very small. We shut down. It's painful, as you say. We feel isolated. You know, we feel all alone. And it's very powerful, I think, to make that exploration, to understand that that's in their nature, and also that we can have a different relationship to them.
Yeah, yeah. One of my favorite ones is the mental factor of conceit, which if you look at the definition, the Buddhist definition of conceit, it has to do with comparing. So this comparing self with other, or comparing one's own experience with other people's experience. And they say that that's one of the hardest things to eliminate. One of the final fetters, when they have these lists, the Abhidhamma is full of these lists. They have these lists of the last fetters, and conceit is one of the final fetters. You know, you can get rid of greed and lust and anger and so on, but there's still that thing of comparing your spiritual attainment with somebody else's, you know, or how much money you're making versus how much someone else is making, you know, like that's really hard to eliminate. And that, those kinds of insights are like just to be discovered in a 2,000-year-old text is pretty incredible.
Yeah, and, you know, discovered in our own minds when we...
Yeah.
And I found it helpful to have some kind of reference. Like, I know one of the characteristics of anger, for example, is persecution.
Yeah.
And especially if I look at anger at myself, when I'm really angry at myself. And there is that kind of merciless persecuting quality.
Yeah.
I think, oh, look at that.
An enemy who has gotten his chance. That's what they say. Like an enemy who has gotten his chance.
Yeah.
But they also say you should regard anger as like stale urine mixed with poison.
Yeah, not really a champion of anger.
I am. I think there's a place for it.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I shouldn't say of course. It's not that obvious. But I think, for me, it comes back to, in part, that understanding of relationship, you know, when we are burdened by kind of the chronic anger and dissatisfaction. And that's one thing, you know, it's quite another thing when we can have some perspective on it and kind of use the energy of it in a way.
Yeah. You heard that thing. I always quote this thing that Thich Nhat Hanh said, or that I made up that Thich Nhat Hanh said, which is to hold anger like a baby.
Yeah, he did say that.
But I always think, oh, there's two ways to, you know, it could be hold anger like a baby, or it could be hold anger the way a baby does, which is like just to, you know, not to be attached to what a terrible person I am for being so angry, you know, but let it liberate itself, you know?
Yeah. Well, that comes back to, in my mind, to mindfulness and add-ons, you know, like there are ways we can experience, say, an emotion that does add an element of isolation to it, and shame and despair, you know, like, why is this still here after 50 years of meditating and all that money in psychotherapy, you know, or we can experience it in a very different way.
Yeah. That's good about the add-ons. I never heard you say that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to experience it purely. And
yeah.
One of my patients who I quote in this book goes to see Ram Dass before Ram Dass died, and confesses to Ram Dass all these, they weren't angry thoughts, they were like lustful thoughts. Like when he's on the subway, he's like sizing up all the people on the subway, like who's attractive, who isn't attractive, who would he like to sleep with, et cetera. And he's sort of ashamed, but still he doesn't want to give up the thing. And he's telling Ram Dass about all this. And Ram Dass says to him first, love the thoughts, you know, like love the thoughts, which is so, so radical, I think, but goes along with the, like the sort of the no add-ons, I think, what you're implying. And then he says, if you love the thoughts, maybe you'll start to see yourself as a soul. You know, not the other, not the, you know, not the people he's evaluating, but see yourself as a soul. Love the thoughts, and maybe you'll see yourself as a soul. And I thought that was so profound, you know, so not what you would anticipate, you know, either front, you know. So I thought that was really Ram Dass at his best, but coming out of our tradition too, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always also considered Ram Dass a really great therapist, you know, and in a way it's like if your therapist loves you anyway, despite that disgusting thing you just told them.
Yeah.
You know, you go, oh, look at that. There's love in the world, even for such as I, you know?
Yeah. 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 Well, that's one of the great things about therapy. You know, anything goes. And it's the underlying relationship that's holding the whole thing.
Yeah. So meditation could be seen perhaps as doing it for oneself. Or maybe.
I think so. Well, I think meditation is like a second chance being with the real you know, in all of your, like Joseph's thing about your crooked heart, you know, whatever that, he always quotes that line. But being with the whole real you in all of your complexity, that we wish our parents, you know, could have, totally accepted and helped us, you know, but, and they did enough that we get to have a second chance, you know, but that then we can learn to do something similar for our own minds, you know, which is, I think, basically creating an environment, a loving environment, a loving and accepting and inquisitive and curious environment in which we can be with ourselves. So I have a quite, you know, the famous Buddha, last words, or they weren't really his last words, but they were his almost last words.
An island unto yourself, be a light.
Or be a lamp unto yourself. The same, like, which one is it? Or is it the same word as translated? Well,
is dipa, right? That's the word, which means light. Yeah.
I mean, I really like that, be a lamp unto yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know?
But an island.
So isolated.
Well, I don't know if it's true. I think that speaks to you, to the topic also of, you know, isolation and aloneness and loneliness and making that okay. But I just find it curious that it could go either way.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, like in our time, well, there are two things that are coming to my mind. One is back in the day when we were teaching together physically in the same room.
Yeah.
Which, who knows? Maybe that'll come up again.
I know, we can do it again.
We should do it again. And you would often quote D.W. Winnicott, who was a British psychoanalyst of, I guess, the 50s, right?
Yeah, 40s.
And 50. One of his great lines was, be a good enough mother.
Yeah.
And you would always say, kind of parenthetically, that it was the women who were always presenting with the kids. And that's why it's not just like good enough parent.
Yes.
But be a good enough mother. And someone would always raise their hand and say, what's a good enough mother? And you would say, someone who can survive their child's rage.
Yeah.
And then they'd say, what does it mean to survive your child's rage? Yeah. And you'd say, neither getting too like invasive nor too distant.
Yeah.
And I would always then say, well, that's like mindfulness.
Totally.
It's right there. It's what you're describing, is this kind of loving environment that is holding everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I always, when I've been on retreat often, and I, you know, alone in one of those little rooms at the forest refuge, and setting myself up for my practice, and sometimes this phrase from the sutras would come to me, which was like, the monk sits cross-legged and places his mindfulness before him. And I always thought, you know, I have a lot of time to contemplate that phrase when I'm sitting there all alone. So he places his mindfulness before him, like it's like that's such a, you know, like I was thinking of it like a vase that you put there, but that it's a sensibility that you can wear, you know, or that you can make, fill the room with, you know, and enter. And that's like the good enough mother thing, you know, like what's great about Winnicott, because he talked directly to parents. He didn't use like fancy language. He was, so the good, being a good enough mother was like, you know, you already have it in you is what he's trying to say, you know, and just not retaliating and not abandoning in the face of what's difficult. The most difficult thing being the child's anger, but it could be anything, you know? He's saying that's he called it the facilitating environment that a parent naturally creates for a child out of love and devotion, you know. But the facilitating environment is what allows the child to be themselves. And I think that's exactly when we taught together and you would see the parallels, that's exactly what mindfulness, what meditation is doing for us, creating the facilitating environment in which, you know, our own minds can grow.
Yeah.
And therapy maybe can come along, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about the kind of just the times we are in where not everyone was completely isolated in the last 3 years, but many were. And people who weren't, who are still working, for example, outside the home or going out, experience often another kind of isolation, in that the church maybe they were used to going to was not a possibility, or the concert they would go to lift their spirits was not a possibility. And maybe they couldn't visit their parents because of some vulnerability. And I don't know to what degree we've emerged, you know, I mean, physically or in terms of relationship and gatherings for many people, though not everybody, that's shifted. And yet, you know, like, what a time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting because for some people, probably a minority, but for some people, that withdrawal, that pulling back was experienced as incredibly enriching and rewarding,
mm-hmm.
in a surprising way, you know, because the busyness of life was taken away, and so the openness and freedom, really, of not having to rush and being, you know, like being able to go out for a walk and really see what the spring, that first spring of the pandemic, you know, being able to see with everything, so no cars on the road, no people, just the flowers emerging, you know. So I think for some people it was a boon, but for many, many people, the being thrust back on oneself was a real challenge. And I think it made people appreciate actually what they had heretofore taken so much for granted. I think that's sort of the nice thing about now, even though no one has figured out if the pandemic is really over or not over, but people have sort of decided it's over. So the first experiences of going to a cultural event, going to the movies, going out to dinner inside, seeing friends and family. I mean, that's been going on for a while for a lot of people, but I think there's a kind of renewed appreciation, similar to what happens when you come out of a meditation retreat and, you know, you have your first conversation, or you go back home and it's like everything is so much brighter, you know? So I think there's been some nice things that have come from it.
Sometimes just the sheer intensity of an experience has us feel isolated. We can't quite believe that anyone would understand, or that it happens to other people, or, you know, there's a kind of specialness we feel.
Yeah. That's one of the things, that we've all been through this together. So as much as we've all been isolated, there's also a kind of universal thing that was really a shared experience that I think people are in a hurry to forget. But everything I've read about the flu pandemic, you know, of whenever that was, 1918, mm-hmm. You know, so many people died and everything, but when it was over, everyone just like rushed forward, you know, and rarely looked back. I think there's going to be something similar, or there is already something similar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things about, I think, that journey from isolation to connection, or constriction and narrowness to freedom, is that it's not a straight line. You know, we go up and we know that. I mean, I certainly entered meditation thinking there's going to be the breakthrough experience. And after that, you know, there will just be, it'll all be fine. You know, it'll be just fine. And yeah. It's just not like that.
There were breakthrough experiences.
But there were definitely breakthrough experiences. Yeah. And then sometimes things were hard again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's just the nature of things.
And it makes you question, wait a minute. Yeah, exactly. But that's it. But that, so much insight comes from that, you know, realizing that it's so much more complicated, you know, or so much simpler than what we think.
So I was at a very, very early conference on Buddhism and psychotherapy, I guess is what it was. And Jack Engler was one of the people on my panel, and there was a Tibetan Lama. And at one point, the question went to Jack of like, "Have you ever written a care plan or a treatment goal?" I don't know what the actual language is.
Treatment plan.
Yeah, a treatment plan for somebody where, like, the goal would be that they help other people. You know, that they have kind of kindness, acts of kindness and service. And he said, well, no, you know, it's not like that. So I was just curious about that.
Yeah, the field doesn't think that way. Being able to engage in activities of daily living, that would be about as close as anyone would come in a treatment plan. Or for people in a family, with a family, being able to go back and care for one's children or one's spouse or one's parents or whatever, that could be part of it. That's, our society, we're such an individually oriented society that being able to get back to work is more the. Yeah, those early conferences were good, you know.
Yeah.
They brought together so many people trying to figure out how these things could go together. I remember there was one that R.D. Lang came to. He said, we're all afraid of three things, each other, our own minds, and death. I thought, oh, R.D. Lang.
You know? Yeah, really? There we go.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that happens, of course, in any kind of introspection is we look at what we're afraid of. It comes up. We look at what's painful. And that, of course, is not easy, but it seems to be the liberating factor, you know, is that we're not kind of dancing around it or avoiding it or engaging in some behavior to not have it be so upfront. And whatever it is, it's like, there it is.
Yeah.
And in therapy, of course, there's the therapist who's accompanying you on that journey. In meditation, perhaps you have a teacher or a community who are also accompanying you, or perhaps you feel very alone in doing that. But it seems to me it's a similar process of...
Yeah, with similar potential... obstacles or difficulties. Like, do you think it's possible? Have you seen people using meditation to hide from what scares them?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, same with therapy. That's the tricky thing, I think, to allow yourself to settle into where the fear really is.
Yeah, I mean, I feel incredibly lucky in having had really good teachers, you know?
Yeah.
But it's certainly easy because there's so many different levels. I mean, I find that as a writer, you know, as I'm sure you do as well, just writing about these things, it's so easy to kind of veer off into, it's all bright and wonderful. Don't worry about it, you know, when you're writing about love.
Yeah.
And to sort of say, oh, there's this side too, you know, and this is inevitable and it doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. And it's okay. It's really, you can be okay in the face of this. It's not that easy.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, I quote you in my book, Real Life.
I quote you in my books.
Great.
I quote you from Faith.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. This is what I quote you saying. Grief and love are connected. If we push the mourning, the grief, the sadness away, we're also pushing the love away. By doing so, we are creating a much more constrained way of living. So can you say some more about that?
Yeah. Well, one of the... I think of it as a privilege of being a therapist, but that over the years now, because I've been doing it for a while, people have come in the aftermath of terrible losses, you know, like terrible loss, children and spouses and parents and their own illnesses and whatnot. So grief, you know. What is grief really, and how difficult it can be just to allow it, and to allow it to take its own course, you know, not to superimpose, like I should be grieving this way, or it should be over now, or I thought it was over, but it's here again. And how do you, not experiencing enough of it, you know, just all the ways that we get hung up around it. And I've just been so up close to so much grief. And, you know, the operating premise that we talked about already for me as the therapist is trying to create that space I think we've talked about a lot already, where just be with what is, you know, and be with it how it is, you know. And that's really let me see that love and grief, love and sadness, even love and anger, you know, love and jealousy, like that all those things are connected. And most of us are so conditioned or just so fearful of our own destructive potential, you know, that we're scared to let the so-called negative emotions, you know, the more difficult emotions, we're scared to acknowledge them, either in our own internal selves or even with a therapist or a loved one, or but to have faith that things really will self-liberate if you give them the right kind of attention, lets you see that it's not some negative part of you that's angry or sad or grieving, you know, that we don't have parts, you know, that there's only one of us and that it's all connected, you know, so that the more we can open to the difficult feelings, the more we can feel our own love. That I feel very confident about now. So I try to, without preaching about it, I try to let people know that maybe it's safe, and then maybe it you know, all this really is about love. You know,
it's beautiful.
The thing that I always quote from you from the beginning of your book about faith, where you're writing about your early emotional experience, you know, growing up with losing your parents in all these horrible ways, and then coming to meditation and finding that those negative self feelings, you know, were that if you gave them the right kind of attention, that suddenly they weren't the definition of who you were, you know. I mean, you using that was so generous of you, Sharon, to put all that out there, and so helpful to so many people. So,
well, thank you.
To me included.
Thank you. It was, of course, a very difficult book to write, and yet very important. And it was one of those experiences I was compelled to write that book. You know, I had to write that book. And, you know, my original publisher didn't like anything I was writing. I had to break that contract and find a new publisher. And
really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was just, and I didn't even know why, you know, or what I had to say. And it was only in that second process with my second contract that I signed a contract for an autobiographical treatment of faith in the Buddhist tradition. So right there, it became my story.
Right.
And I had a freelance editor who was helping me, and we would have these conversations like she'd say, well, isn't doubt like the opposite of faith? And I'd say, no, not really. Like the right kind of doubt, you know, and questioning and wondering and insisting on seeing the truth for yourself, all of that, I think, really enhances faith. So what's the opposite of faith then? And I said, despair.
Yeah.
And she said, well, then you have to write a chapter on despair. And I said, I don't think so. I don't really want to. Let's not go there, you know. But of course, she was right. And I went there. And so it was a very important book for me to write. And so,
yeah. So I, you know, I think that's going to last forever, that book.
Yeah. Thank you. Now I have another one.
Good. May that one be as good.
May it be so. I mean, that's the beautiful thing, you know, for an author in terms of these efforts. It's like you just put it out there and you do the best you can to be authentic and integrate it in your own presentation. And you never know.
Yeah.
I have a friend, I had met her in a conference somewhere, and then we completely lost touch. And this was my first book, Loving Kindness. She was in a bookstore and it fell on her head. Just like fell off the shelf on her head.
Yeah.
So we got back in touch and we've been friends ever since. And you think like, what's coming at me? You know, from what direction? You never know.
The power of the book.
Power of the book. May it be so. So thank you for all of your writing and all of your efforts and your thinking without a thinker.
Yes.
You know, it's really been, you've helped so many people.
That's
So before we end our time together, is there a kind of practice or reflection you'd like to lead us in?
Sure. You know, I've been very inspired by the musician and composer John Cage. You've heard me talk about him before, because he was one of the first to take non-musical sounds, supposed non-musical sounds, and try to see the music in them. So he's famous for a lot of things, but he's particularly famous for a concert that he once gave that was 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, which he gave in an outdoor amphitheater that's close to where I'm speaking from. So that was really the sounds of the audience and the sounds of nature and all the ambient sounds that became the concert, you know. So I found it can be a nice way to introduce people to meditation or to come at it from a slightly different angle instead of using the breath or watching thoughts and so on, just to focus on sounds. So it's a little weird over the computer and so on, but we could do it it doesn't even have to be 4 minutes and 33 seconds. But if people who are listening or watching could just settle back into their meditative posture and allow the body to be held by the cushion or the chair or the couch or wherever you're sitting, And then I really like this thing I once heard you say, Sharon, which is let the mind settle into the body the way the body is settled into the cushion, into the chair. You probably said it better than me. So just allow yourself to be supported, to be held. And turn your attention to what we call in Buddhist psychology, the ear door, which is the portal in the body where the sounds enter. Just turn your awareness to whatever surrounds you in the way of sound. Silent or not. And let the sounds come and go as they will. You have no control over them, obviously. Don't push away the unpleasant ones if there are any. Don't cling to the pleasant ones if there are any. And let yourself be with the neutral ones. Noticing anything that might come up in your mind that pulls you away from the ear door. Worries or fears, random thoughts, plans, leftover emotions, hunger pains. Anything that distracts you, just notice, oh, that's that. But let yourself then return to whatever surrounds you in the way of sound. Almost like a sound bath. After dwelling in that space, bring yourself back so you can see Sharon, see me, and I know, speaking for myself, what a special opportunity this has been to be with Sharon again. I've loved teaching with for Loves on now, not quite 50 years.
Well, thank you so much. It's wonderful to see you and hear you. And I feel like I want to listen to this again and again, you know, to hear you, not me, but I hear myself enough.
We all are.
I mean, it's a tremendous joy spending time with you, Mark. And to learn more about his work, visit markepsteinmd.com, markepsteinmd.com, and go get a copy of The Zen of Therapy, wherever books are sold. Thank you.
Hey, folks, thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon's many different offerings, her courses, virtual classes, or to get a copy of Real Life, you can visit SharonSalzberg.com. This has been the Real Life series on the Metta Hour podcast, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.